Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, the creator of user-friendly fundraising software that helps nonprofits engage donors, raise more money, and save valuable time and resources. OneCause recently surveyed over 1,000 peer-to-peer fundraising participants to understand the key to fundraising success. Their findings are eye-opening. The study uncovers clear best practices for growing your peer-to-peer fundraising campaigns and empowering your fundraisers. Download a copy of the OneCause Social Fundraiser Study today by visiting www.onecause.com/responsive20. That's www.onecause.com/responsive20. Hi, Leslie. Thank you for being my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We sort of teed it up before the holidays, and now you're back, and we're going to talk about your research. Before we do that, why don't you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, I'm Leslie Alborough. I am currently a research fellow at the University of Kent, which is based here in Canterbury in the United Kingdom. I am an ex-fundraiser turned researcher, and I'm here to share some of the research findings from my PhD, I hope, and some of the thinking that I'm engaging with now.
I appreciate that you identify yourself as an ex-fundraiser who turned researcher. I tend to think that some of the researchers out there haven't done a whole lot of fundraising, so I appreciate that.
Yeah.
But how does one, before we dive deep into your research, how does one sort of become a researcher after? I mean, is fundraising so screwed up that we have to sort of we become ex-fundraisers and we got to go sort of find out what's wrong with it? Is that what's going on or what?
No, I don't think it's that. I think, as we all know, fundraising is a hard job. It's a full-time job. It's a more than full-time job.
Yeah.
And the pressures are huge to bring in the income, to build up the relationships that you need. And there just often isn't that time and space to just engage deeply with some of the questions that bother us and sit at the back of our minds as fundraisers. And I'd got to that point where I had all these huge questions about our fundraising practice and the impact it was having, but just not being able to find the research or the thinking out there or access it that was available, either because it was behind a paywall, which is still a frustration we have in academia and the way we produce and publish research in academia. But also because I think you've pointed out that many researchers aren't fundraisers. Yeah. So a lot of the fundraising research that is out there is rather naive and not embedded in our practices. And I found that I either needed to back off from the fundraising practice for a while or just accept that the research that I was accessing wasn't reflecting back to me my experience of the fundraising world. So I went for the former and stepped back from the research a bit. So when I say ex-fundraiser, I still am a volunteer fundraiser. Still am a trustee. I still talk to fundraisers every day. So, but my primary objective now is to engage fundraisers and fundraising professionals and those raising money in organizations to talk about and tell me about their experiences so that I can start to kind of unpack what some of those are and maybe ask some of the big questions that were bothering me before I embarked on this journey and still bother me now. So no, fundraising isn't messed up. Fundraising just is too busy often to be able to ask the big questions that researchers, particularly in an academic context, we have the space, the time, and the luxury to ask the questions and then go and look for the answers.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the joys that I have found as a so what I have managed to do since I left full-time employment is I've started consulting and I've started doing what I'm doing here with you. And I've started doing a lot of writing and teaching at the local college. But one of the things that I have found that this work, like this time right here on this podcast, almost is like a constant sort of research paper. And so, you know, last year I think we did 84 of these episodes and we're constantly listening to fundraisers. And so, I'm so right there with you that I think some of the research that's out there is naive and that it isn't being informed by the practitioner, who's got the boots on the ground.
Exactly.
And quite frankly, it's too, in my mind, it's too reductionist and sort of analytical. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of, if we do not begin to see and understand sort of the relationship between the donor and the fundraiser as an agent of the organization and sort of what emerges from that, and we don't begin to understand what all is sort of playing out there, I don't think we're going to get better at it. That's my little mini soapbox for a minute. So just at a very high level, what was the question that you wanted to answer with your work?
So I started out, I was working in a big international development organization, and I was struck by how distanced and how little I understood about how my organization actually functioned, and even less about how my organization understood about how I functioned. That led me to a question about to what extent that can fundraising or does fundraising stand as a barrier between the donor and the beneficiary group rather than as being aided, you know, as if, you know, we talk about that we facilitate generosity and we connect a donor and a fundraiser, a beneficiary. But I just wasn't seeing that. And I was trying to find a lot out there that kind of told me, how do you get around that, or does it matter? And I guess, so my main question started out was to what extent can fundraising and does fundraising hinder the mission statement of the organization?
Okay.
Unintentionally. And so that was my starting point. And, I asked that of my supervisor, who said, well, why don't you come and do this piece of research and engage with the process yourself? But as you say, the process of research, it can be very reductionist. You have to get to a really simple question.
Yeah. Yep.
It's really hard to get at all the complexity of it. So I found myself stepping into a world where I had to leave a lot of my very practitioner knowledge to one side and be very intentional about that and then understand and try and engage with how the research process could possibly engage with complexity and then bring them back together. And that's going to be a lifelong process. And hopefully I'm in the space now where you are, where we're developing this idea of a pracademic. Uh-huh. It's very popular in disciplines such as social work, and nursing practices, where you don't stop practicing, but you're not a full-time researcher either. And so there's you're practicing it yourself. You're still practicing. You're still grappling with the day-to-day challenges of being a fundraiser, but you're also stepping aside and going, well, and constantly reflecting on your practice and seeking out other people who are doing the same and then trying to come to a point where maybe we can move forward, or we've got different ways of seeing things and therefore different ways of understanding things. You just have chosen to do it within your management consultancy, and I've chosen to do it in a university. So I'm kind of really enjoying playing with this idea of being a pracademic.
Maybe that's Leslie, what it's going to take. So when I think about my 25 years in this space, I think about watching, not into the academia, but this transition that a lot of fundraisers tend to make into consulting. And one of the critiques that I've had on those individuals has been that they never develop the muscles or the confidence to sort of be in the fundraising space. And so they go hide in consulting.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, these people, they get the mechanics of it and they get the technique and they've certainly got the how-tos down, but it doesn't resonate from within them. And so when I think about it from the academic sense, I want the same thing. I want people who can sort of, I was at a conference over in the UK a couple of years ago, with some of your friends. And I remember speaking to somebody from one of the prestigious schools here in the US, and I was listening to her and I was thinking, you know, you're just not, it's not coming from within you, you know, you've got it all up in your head intellectually, what it means to do fundraising. And you could certainly sort of break it down into the mechanics and technique, but I don't know that you get it sort of deep down within you what it means to sit across the lunch table and ask somebody for $100,000. You know that. You know what I mean?
Well, this is it, and I think this is what my research kind of really came up and sort of clarified for me. I kind of knew it naturally as a fundraiser, is that there's a lot about fundraising that is simply not taught and cannot be learned through understanding in a marketing technique or a customer relationship building technique. There's a lot that is about, for want of a better word, knowing in practice. So you bring a whole skill set with you to your fundraising process, and that's your passion and your drive to be part of this organization and what they're doing and to learn what they're doing and bring donors on board. But there's also the process of just learning and engaging with donors. And I think there's also this space where I am stuck with, certainly when I speak to fundraisers just know a lot of stuff. There's this inert humanity, or part of their humanity. Is it empathy? I struggle with the notion of empathy, but that you can't get and you can't gain if you've only ever researched or looked at the fundraising process from the side. I think also part of the big problem, and you hit on it in your War on Fundraising Talent book, is that most of what we know and understand about fundraising is based on what big organizations and what skill sets and technology, et cetera, big organizations can buy.
Yeah, right.
And the truth of the matter is most fundraising isn't about a bought product. It's about engaging with real human beings who want to engage with real human beings, or a huge landscape, or a historical concept, or a piece of artwork. Yes, I think we are finding that as we professionalize in the fundraising sector and the charitable sector, and we want to look more like business and engage more like business. I don't know why we want to do that, because a lot of what the organizations we are sitting in are kind of raging against that sort of big capitalist business narrative and saying we want to be more human and kind and equitable. So our fundraising practice is not looking like that mission statement anymore. But those of us who are researching it are going, oh, well, we're appropriating all these theories, and they range from psychological theories to marketing theories, and we kind of place them and we overlay them on what we think we're seeing and observing, rather than actually talking to fundraisers and saying to them, what is it you actually do? What is it you have to think about? Who do you have to talk to? And then recognizing that actually isn't a nice, neat pathway of developing a case for support.
Maybe that's the advantage of timing, though. Maybe what you're describing for you and me, for where you and I find ourselves in the sort of this, I'm oftentimes referring to it as the messy adolescence. what you and I have the advantage of is that those people that couldn't necessarily have been talked to, 15 or 20 years ago, because quite frankly, there just wasn't that sort of volume of people who had been in the field long enough to have gotten to the place where they could think critically about what it is we were doing.
Yeah.
I think a lot about a lot of the people that I've engaged with over the last, say, 24 months. And a lot of them have been these people individuals who have gotten sort of beyond the credentialing process, and they're starting to think critically. You know, they're doing well in their work. They're running into some typical challenges, you would say, 10 years in.
Yeah.
But they're also starting to they're starting to own it. They're owning it in a very meaningful and significant way. And so they're thinking more critically about what it is they're doing. And what they're also doing is they're showing up at seminars and conferences and those sorts of places. And they're finding that that they're still sort of hearing the same old sort of cliched, you know, 101 sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's the evolution. So for the consultant, the person in my posture, the academic in your posture, and even the association that's organizing all of this, I think we're all being sort of, you know, pushed to another level and being told, okay, you know, we got to grow up here a little bit. What's your thoughts on that?
I think that is. I mean, we've been asking ourselves a lot in the sector as well. Is fundraising a profession? And do we? And then we've looked at the sociological literature on professionalization, and then we've looked at the economics literature on professionalization. And when we decide that become a profession, we have to have this good knowledge base and theory base. And I think we've been, is certainly in the research world on fundraising, that's what we've been trying to establish, is this theoretical and knowledge base based on other sectors and other practices that we think are similar to fundraising. So we appropriate a lot of the language. And do we have a good set of ethical frameworks? Well, yes and no, we're developing those, but they're kind of based on a flawed knowledge or an immature knowledge. And then we've kind of decided that the focus is on whether we can say, oh, we're a profession, like becoming a medical profession, well, a professional or a social worker or et cetera, without kind of going, well, actually, some of us are professionals. Some of us are volunteers. Some of us just tag fundraising on to what is our profession. And I think we miss the debate. We are a profession, but as you say, we're an adolescent profession, and we're a profession that's thinking about ourselves. And we've all reached this point where now it actually is something legitimate and a thing you can do post school, and you can study it. And you can, but at the same time, as you're saying, is that those studies aren't giving us this sense of purpose and this sense of understanding and critical engagement with the organizations that we're working with and the concepts and the causes we're working with that we were seeking out when we first entered into this profession or practice.
Isn't it also too, so I remember when I was working on that first book, I remember looking at, I found a paper or a lecture. It was a speech. It was a speech that a leader of a large association representing social workers wrote. This is 100 years ago. And the title of it, I'll put a link in my show notes here, was "Are We a Profession?" And it was the question that was being asked of social workers, and because they were asking the same. And I remember reading through this, and there was a lot of these questions that he was referring to in his speech. And forgive me for not remembering his name, but I think also one of the things that I think fundraising is what is so messy about where we find ourselves now in the context of professionalization. And by the way, Leslie, I'm so glad we're going to have you back for a second episode, because we're staying very high level and we're going off on tangents, but I think we're having fun too. was this idea that professionalization basically means better pay. And I think that's one of the things that we're struggling with now. I think more professionalized people, more people who can deliver on better outcomes and stuff, certainly are do better compensation. But what this guy was talking about in the context of social work 100 years ago was saying that professionalization really is not about, it's more about the camaraderie within a group that shares common values, and it's the ethics, and it's those sorts of things. It's not just having sort of this resume building process.
Yes.
Where has that sort of, when you talk about professionalization, how do you compare that with like this notion of just simply resume building? Because I feel like that's what a lot of our quote unquote professional fundraisers are out there doing, is they're not professionalizing. They're just building a resume that'll get them a better job. I don't think that's helping them.
Yeah. So I think that there's a number of issues there is first of all, it's the nature of fundraising and who the fundraisers are in organizations. They tend to be one or two people. So the idea of progress, so not just in terms of having a more senior position or having better pay within organizations is limited for fundraisers. So if you want to specialize or you want to become a trust or foundations fundraiser or you want to learn something new outside of your organization, sometimes that can be, well, that your organization can't provide for you. That's quite difficult. So a lot of fundraisers, if they want to move on, they have to move out or sideways into another organization. But I think there's always that temptation. We buy into this just as much as anybody else, is that society's indicators of success and good are you paid a lot of money? Do you have perks? Do you have recognition? And so fundraisers are in this really funny space where they can't necessarily find that within very socially orientated mission-based organizations because that's not what the language is in those spaces. And I guess people like Dan Pilotta was trying to grapple with that when he wrote his book, Uncharitable, and when he did his TED talk, was this idea that just being paid more is not necessarily and being remunerated well is not necessarily at odds with a socially based mission. But then there's also this idea that fundraising and there are two kind of trains of thoughts in professionalization. That professionalization is about doing something well and doing something that benefits the people you are doing it for, as well as yourself, as well as the organization you're doing it for. And not just in profitable terms, but in moral terms, in ethical terms, in value-based terms. But then there's professionalization that shows that I've got all the credentials and all the things that say I'm good at my job and therefore I can earn more money or I can have this particular status. Whereas it sounds like the talk you're referring to is trying to refer to professionalization as the former, as the space that professionalization is making sure as a doctor you do no harm. Right. You know, as a nurse, you love and care for your patients. That's part of the professionalization process. And I think fundraisers, I mean, certainly the fundraisers I were talking to, there's this little bit of notion of going, actually, fundraising is that moral and ethical space. And we talk about it when we talk because of the mission-based work we're supposed to be raising money for, and because we're also looking after donors who are not just very wealthy people and even just very wealthy people are people and humans with feelings. That doesn't go away just because you've got money.
Yeah.
But we're also, our donors are also people who can only give you $2 or £2 a month, you know, and so you've got to look after them. But fundraisers have this very moral and ethical approach to it. And I think maybe it's in the professionalization language we are accessing and research we are accessing as fundraising researchers and fundraising practitioners is the wrong set of professionalization notions and values. What we want to do is access work by people like, say, Balaheer Sangira, who talks about a moral sentiments approach. Yes. To professionalization, that you are a whole person, that you bring a sense of feeling and thinking, and emotion management, et cetera, to your work. People like, Sarah Bolton, she writes about emotion management in the work. Arlie Hochschild, who, started us thinking about how if we try and co-opt all these feelings and try to make them too professional within a traits-based profession, you know, the very rationalized form of professionalization, you're going to miss the boat a bit. People like Beth Breeze has tried to grapple with this idea and has suggested that fundraisers are more like artists. So that the professionalization sits in a school of professions around that are creative and emotionally based. you know, I think that's part of the problem is that we're looking at what professional is in the wrong light.
So I worked in urban education for a short time, and I really got to understand the sort of the tension between Du Bois and what Booker T. Washington were trying to do for the African American man in the, you know, in the post Civil War sort of economy.
Yeah.
And what I really began to understand was that Du Bois was trying to sort of position the African American man as someone who could sort of lead and be established, as a leader, whereas Booker T was sort of pushing for this sort of knowing how to participate in the economy. And what Du Bois would be arguing with today would be this sort of what ends up happening when we just participate in the economy is we sort of maintain our marginalization. And that's what I think that's part of what I think our challenges are in fundraising is that we haven't sort of become fundraising leaders because we're just fundraising technicians.
Yes.
And so what Booker T did is he took the African American man and he taught him how to work and get jobs and buy homes and have two cars in the driveway. But a lot of people today would still say that the African American man is in many ways just as marginalized as he was 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I certainly don't want to suggest that, you know, fundraisers are sort of in the same boat with the African American community, but I do want to say that any sort of marginalized group needs to think about what it means to sort of be in leadership. Where does that sort of stir you up? And then we're going to sort of push the pause button and bring you back at the end of the week. But where does that, what's your thoughts on that?
So the leadership debate is a space in which I get unstuck all the time. I'm largely because when we say we want to be leaders, we want to be good managers, and we are people who are going to have a group of people underneath us, I suppose, that we're going to mentor and guide through the process. I think leadership and our notions of leadership is so we've become very particularly in modern day society, leadership has become this very individualized thing that you do to become a more moral, better leader. Whereas I think fundraisers are in a space that they need to be more collaborative leaders. So it's more servanthood is a term that we use in Christian leadership. There's this idea that you get down on your hands and knees and you wash the feet of the people you are leading. And I just often think that we tend to, with a lot of not-for-profit managers as well as fundraisers, suggest that leadership is a directorship or leadership is sitting on the board and helping make decisions. Whereas I think I'm more with Booker T. Washington on this passage. Good leadership is about being able to show people the way, but at the same time, help them think differently and participate differently and access the economy or the market or the art space, whatever it is that we're trying in a different way, and leading them that way. I guess what's helping me think a little bit about this is Flickstein, who I'm reading at the moment, and he develops this idea called social skill. Which is not social skill in you learn how to communicate well, or you can sit at the table and learn how to eat food well. The normal social skill. It's about being able to reframe and repurpose a story and a pathway, and then set an agenda for people in a way that brings them on board and brings them in as collaborators. And that's what leadership is. But that requires not standing at the front and leading. But it requires sitting down and experiencing and knowing what the people you are talking to and engaging with and wanting to help or lead their day-to-day experiences are, and then helping them see them and then participate or change them in a certain way. At the moment, fundraisers don't do that very well, either for donors or for the organizations they're working for, because fundraisers tend to take the organization's story and repurpose it a little bit and reframe it in order to get a donor to behave in a certain way, so get the donor to give them money. But they don't do the same reframing or reimagining for the donor, because what they're often doing and what you hear fundraisers doing all the time is trying to just retell the vision of the donor that the donor has of themselves in their heads and their participation, and reproducing, so the donor gets told this. Either the donor is kind of treated really badly, like a customer. And quite frankly, we are customers in other parts of our lives in everyday life. We don't need to be a customer when we're giving, because we're giving. We want to, you know, it's a different process. It's a different social skill and social process. But or we go overboard and we just find ourselves reframing our organizational's mission to help people and help lead people into participation in a different way of life to try and match the donor's view. So what we end up doing is as fundraisers, my fundraisers, certainly the ones that I was talking to, spend a lot of time sort of kind of packaging them themselves, depending on who they're talking to, whether it's their organization and they've got to get people in their organization to help participate in this gift relationship, or whether it's the donor who they're trying to get them to involve in giving to the organization, but they're not really involved in changing the story or leading a change in the story in any way. And it would be but they're in this wonderful position where they could do that. They could be these tempered radicals. And that does, I think, require quite a shift in A, the way we raise money and we talk to our donors and our organizations, but also how we think of ourselves as situated in the organization as leaders. We're not necessarily going to be listened to, but we're going to spend a lot of time doing behind the scenes kind of leadership and servant leadership, which is about listening.
And I think that's a very great, because what you're sort of, what you're challenging me to sort of think about is the idea of sort of, I've been spending a lot of time with sort of the train of thought that sort of informed the Industrial Revolution, and a lot of this comes out of the Enlightenment and stuff, and it's the difference between thinking and doing. And so we paid, we had the thinkers, the brilliant, smart thinkers who were supposed to know how to make everything run, and the doers who were supposed to be, they could be anything, as long as you could pick up a hammer or something or turn a wrench, you were expected to do the job. And I think what you're describing is someone who knows how to sort of do both. And I think our economy is moving to that place. I think we're becoming a much more, and I certainly think that's relevant in a lot of different areas of work, is that we don't have to sort of force ourselves into these two boxes that create sort of this elite group of people who are expected to have all the answers versus these people who just turn wrenches. And I think fundraising, if you think about sort of this adolescence, this messy adolescence that we're coming out of, I think part of what we're working out now is, I think we had that really well-established elite that sort of we all sort of envied, and they had all the answers, which would be very characteristic of sort of a childhood where, there was a sparse few who sort of knew how to get this done. And then the whole, the masses were sort of just following their lead. Whereas now I think we can think more critically about this, and we can be less dependent upon gurus and, sort of changes the game, certainly for people like you and I who are trying to sort of lead the direction of where people are thinking.
Yeah. I mean, and it does. It requires us to kind of spend a lot more time understanding where people are at, and then bringing other thinkers, as we're doing, into that framework and saying, well, actually, we can help you widen your scope and experience and what you draw on to do your stuff for you. But we have to understand you and who you are, and what you need in order to do that appropriately. Okay. Our expertise doesn't just come from the fact that we've read a whole lot of stuff.
So folks, we're going to let you all go, and we're going to bring Leslie back. We're really just going to hit the pause button for a few minutes, take a break, and we're going to bring Leslie back on Thursday. And we're actually going to focus, rather than letting my ADD sort of just wander and take this conversation anywhere I wanted it to, we're going to let Leslie focus in on her research. So please come back with us on Thursday. Leslie, before we hit the pause button, can you just tell everyone where they can find the information, remind us the name of the research, and then we'll come back on Thursday.
So it's scintillatingly titled Fundraisers and the Mediated Gift, and it can be accessed through the University of Kent's in the UK, not in the US's, library. But if you – I have written a paper as well for the International Journal of Voluntary Sector Marketing. But if you want access to either one of those and you can't get access because it's behind a paywall, because it's academia, please do email me. My details are on the University of Kent's website.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.